Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So here we are, the 18th of July, the day after our much-anticipated Word in the Park in Holland Park, our return to, much-delayed return to, in-person appearances.
After 18 months of being online. Incredible, wasn't it? And we had gorgeous baking heat. There were enlivening drinks. There were people in shorts. I felt there was a competition to see who could wear the coolest the most faded rock T-shirt. I felt that.
It was an extraordinary place, though, wasn't it? Because it was Opera Holland Park, which is they have a covered auditorium, which normally seats 1,500, but obviously because of social distancing, they had to redesign it this year, so it takes 400 or something like that, and so it's individual seats, isn't it? You know, three here, two here, one there, one. You know. Yeah. It's a really unusual setup.
An incredibly comfortable setup, actually. None of that sort of normal feeling of crush and, you know, crowd that you get. I thought it was really lovely. Yeah, really
people were so relaxed when they got there, because it was such a gorgeous day and it's such a gorgeous place. They were in such a good mood at the start. So we're going to pat ourselves on the back, it went very well.
It went really well. I think people really enjoyed it. We enjoyed it. I think all the guests enjoyed it. And I got a very good feeling about it. A lot of fun.
So what we're going to do is we recorded all four of our turns from the afternoon, and we'll put them out in four separate podcasts. And so this is the first one, and this young man came first because he had a radio program to go and do. And also, we still regard him as a young man, don't we? We can't get away from this, can we?
We do, and he still looks young.
He does.
And, I mean, just so kind of so boyish and so enthusiastic. He's fantastic, I think.
It was lovely. So our first guest was, one of our personal favourites, Gary Crowley.
In the middle, Gary. And Gary, you're on first, actually, because you've got a radio show later on, haven't you? I think so.
I have. I was saying to the boys a little bit earlier on, I've just got this sort of recurring nightmare. So rewind and go back to the mid-80s, and I was on Capital Radio doing a Sunday evening show, and me and my manager at the time, who's still a really good friend, did the London to Brighton cycle ride on a day like today. So far, so good. We had a real hoot doing it. I was on the back. He was doing most of the cycling. We get to Brighton, which was absolutely packed. And one of the guys who worked at Island Records, my boss was the MD. He got him to drive me back to do the radio show. And of course, you know what happened next. The traffic was absolutely appalling. And I'm looking at the watch. Oh my God, it's 6:30. I'm on at 7:00. It's 6:45. So that's not going to happen today.
But you made sure, didn't you?
I'm going to be an hour early, yeah.
I've got to ask you a question. This is, it's a far more civilised alternative to the rock festival. You know, this is a couple of hours
in a
very salubrious place with toilets nicer than most of the houses that
still
we live
still working,
in.
Yeah.
I want to know, do you never strike me as a rock festival goer?
No, and you're right assuming that. First impressions have a lot to answer sometimes. And the guy who I mentioned a little bit earlier on, you know, a lovely fella called Clive Banks, my third job in music was being his assistant. I went to work for him because he was the kind of coolest radio TV plugger. This is like the late 70s, early 80s. And he'd literally taken on the Kinks. And the Kinks were playing the Reading Festival. This was 1981. And we went on the Sunday. The Kinks were headlining. And it was just, all my nightmares at once, really. Absolutely bucket it down. Wading through the muck and mire. Hello, Mark. Hiya, Maya. And I just couldn't wait to get out of there. But the Kinks were absolutely amazing. It was a very surreal bill as well. It was Wishbone Ash and the Enid. I mean, this is 1981. Well,
these are my people.
For some, but yeah, I mean, it was it was quite a surreal afternoon. But the Kinks were absolutely fantastic.
So we've got to ask you about the Modern World fanzine, which you started in about, what it was, 77, 70, 78, whatever, and an interview about the Pistols and the Clash and the Jam, all sorts of people. Give us some idea of your impressions of those groups then. Well, and did you imagine that they would go on to the level of success that they did?
Well, when I think back to that time, Mark, I just think how easy it sort of seemed in a way, really, because the school that I went to was just tucked behind Edgware Road, Rutherford School. It's been renamed since. And, you know, we had so many punk people sort of, you know, surrounding the school. Steve Jones and Paul Cook literally, you know, lived at the end of the road that our school was on. And I'll always remember this. I can remember coming out of the school once I found out that two Sex Pistols lived at the end of our road. Of course, every time I went home after school, I would always go via their flat. And I'll always remember, you know, coming up and literally seeing this sort of stretch black limousine pulling up and all four Sex Pistols literally falling out. And I mean,
which,
you know,
seems
my
wrong,
eyes,
really, doesn't it? The Sex Pistols in a limousine
and drunk as well. And you know, my eyes were just I was like, what the, really? Oh my god. And I remember interviewing Paul Cook a couple of years ago and telling him about that day, and because I never knew this, and he said that was the day that you know, the limo had been ordered for them because they'd gone to Buckingham Palace to sign to A&M Records. But so you know, where the school was situated was just you know, so you know, we really were in the right place at the right time. Two Pistols at the end of the road, also literally past where they were was Listen Grove Dole Clinic. So, you know, you would see members of the Slits and, you know, other people sort of, you know, walking in and walking out. And then, you know, my favourite memory is coming out of school one, you know, lunchtime and walking up to Edgware Road this time to get my regular, you know, bag of chips for 10p. And Joe Strummer was walking in the opposite direction and would literally just hijack the school magazine and turned it into a fanzine. And I just thought, well, I can't miss this opportunity. I said, Joe, my name's Gary. You know, we've just started this fanzine. We're calling it The Modern World, The Jam. I've got a new song called The Modern World. He didn't know what had hit him. He just literally looked, you know, like that. And but bless his cottons, he said, you know, he was like, calm down. What are you doing tomorrow? Why don't you and a pal...
People have been saying calm down ever since.
They have, and I haven't listened. But no, so he said, listen, why don't a couple of you, you know, come along to the rehearsal studios tomorrow? Rehearsals in Camden. And I said, yeah, of course, yeah, two will be fine, you know. And I got back to school and the word got out and it kind of crept up to about six people. And we turned up dutifully at 4 o'clock the next day in Camden. I was always pushed to the front of the our crowd, and so I knocked on the door, and they had this road manager, a roadie called Rodent, who was quite intimidating, and I remember him answering the door, and you know, what the effing do you want, you know? My voice went up a couple of octaves. Well, I saw Joe yesterday, and he said it was okay if we come down, but anyway, Joe, you know, sort of turned up very, very quickly afterwards. In fact, they all did. It's funny, actually, when I think back to that time, because I made sure that which I thought was sort of quite, you know, ahead thinking in a way, really, to bring a camera. And so, you know, I said to the band, you know, is it possible for me to have my picture taken? You know, so I've got this great photo where the Clash of Five for 1 minute. But yeah, but they were just, you know, and Joe in particular was just absolutely amazing. There was, you know, as I said, there were six of us there. So we interviewed him for about an hour, and I've got the cassette somewhere. You know, if you can imagine Neanderthal boy, but he, you know, he was very, very patient. And then I remember there was a cafe that he liked to go to called George's, which was just near Camden Bridge. And then he invited us all down to that afterwards, and it really meant a lot to me. I know it meant a lot to my pals as well. But as I said, you know, it felt quite easy in a way, really. I think, you know, we were, you know, we loved the music. I think subconsciously, I think we were all waiting for something like punk to happen. I mean, I think you both know I'm a massive Beatles fan as well. But when I got into the Beatles, when I was age 15 years of age, I was like, well, I want something like this for me, you know, and I want a band like the Beatles, and, you know, who kind of dress a little bit differently. And then, of course, you know, 1976, I started buying the music papers, and then you started hearing about punk and the new wave. And the first band who really, you know, who really kind of resonated, again, you know, because of that Beatles influence, was The Jam, you know, because Mr. Weller would name check the Beatles as a big influence, you know, even though at that time it was no Elvis, Beatles or the Rolling Stones. So they were my first band, but The Clash really ran them a very, very close second.
So your policy, your original, you know, encounter with Joe Strummer was meet him in the street to speak to him. Is that a policy you've followed ever since with, you know, have you gone up to rock stars on the street and said, you never heard of me, I like you?
Not really, but it's funny, you know, over this past year and enjoying the word in your attic interviews, I think, David, you might have said to somebody about those people that you kind of, for want of a better term, fall in love with when you're in your sort of mid-teens. You know, those ones are always right up there, I think. And, you know, whether it's been, you know, being lucky enough to have interviewed, you know, Paul McCartney a couple of times and Ringo, never got to do George. We went to the first time that I ever went to New York. I was incredibly lucky. I was this was 1980, and we went. Pete Townsend paid for me to go to New York because I was working for this guy Clive, who I mentioned a little bit earlier on. And Clive did The Who and Elvis Costello and The Pretenders. So The Pretenders were playing the New York Palladium. I'd sorted out some skinheads for the Kenny Everett performance of Pete Townsend's Rough Boys track. And I had to go. So this is 1980. So I had to go to places like, you know, the Hammersmith Palais and hand out invitations to, you know, the toughest looking skinheads and say, listen, do you want to come to the Kenny Everett show? You know, because they're performing. Blah, blah. And it was packed. In fact, it's up there on YouTube. If you, freeze frame it. I mean, I'm in there somewhere. And Pete, very, very generously, you know, paid for me to go to New York to see The Pretenders, and then up to Toronto to see The Who. And this was the first tour with Kenny Jones on drums as well. So going right round the houses there, in answer to your question, I've always been a fan, and you know, I think, you know, right at the very, very beginning, I was always interested in the process, in the people who produced the records sometimes, and, you know, the PR people, the managers, obviously. You know, Andrew Lou Goldham is a friend on Twitter, which still blows my mind. So, yeah, that's it, basically. Thank you. Good night.
So how do you...
We thought we'd never get a word out of him, actually. I'm astonished.
Sorry, carry on. Go on.
Go on. No, I just said we thought we'd never get a word out of him.
Yeah, I was worried that we wouldn't winkle him out of his shell, but it's going all right so far. How do you find your encounters with the Beatles?
Well, you know, the day interviewing Paul McCartney for the first time was just the most... I mean, I could get emotional thinking about it, really. I mean, I cannot tell you, you know, how special they were to me. I mean, I kind of got the Beatle bug through watching an episode of Tony Palmer's All You Need Is Love, and one program was completely dedicated to them. And if my memory serves me correctly, it opened with them performing Some Other Guy at the Cavern, and I was like, what the... I mean, I'd heard of them, but that episode just absolutely, you know, galvanized me. And then everything, it was all about the Beatles afterwards. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of money around the house, but I'd go to secondhand shops and you know, start buying records. And in fact, there was a group of kids in the secondary that I went to, about two or three of us who I knew were Beatles fans as well. So, you know, we would kind of sort of lend each other records. And you know, sort of swap magazines, and if there were any articles. I mean, a big thing was going to the library as well, and you know, getting out books like George Melly's Revolt into Style, and you know, Hunter Davis's biography on the band as well, and you know, those were kind of like special trips. But interviewing, you know, Mr. McCartney that day, it was for the Run Devil Run album, and you know, we did the interview at the offices in Soho, and I think we were told, you know, that we were going to get 20 minutes or something, and I mean, as I said, I'm a massive Beatles fan, and you know a lot of the story, but he seemed very, very relaxed that afternoon, bless him. In fact, he was going off to do later with Jules Holland, and he was telling me things. He was talking about you know, Hamburg and Liverpool, stuff that I hadn't read before, and I think we ended up getting 40 minutes, and he had this lovely PR guy called Jeff Baker.
It's such a great ruse, that, isn't it? You've only got 20 minutes, then when you get more, you think, it's me!
Well, I mean, that's why, because he loves me.
Absolutely.
Well, it's so funny you should say that, because on the way out, I floated out of the office, and Jeff Baker, who's a lovely, lovely guy, said, he liked you, you got 40.
They
and,
say that to the older boys.
Did you get it? Oh, no!
Because the other knack that McCartney's got, I don't know if you've noticed this, is he always says, I've met you before.
Yeah. Right.
Because he clearly has met everybody before. You know, so it's a natural working assumption.
Yes.
He's met somebody before.
Yes.
And they remember it.
I mean, I remember, you know, when I would have first met, you know, you two guys, you know, I mean, Mark used to come
that would be bound to go to anybody's head.
I used to be the receptionist. I mean, obviously, Danny's coming on a little bit later on, and I took over.
Two former receptionists from the NME.
Yeah, and Danny, so Mark used to come into the NME, and I've told him this before, but he was kind of, he had this sort of kind of young Paul McCartney sort of droopy eyes thing. I always kind of remember that. And David was at the at Smash Hits, but you would go out to lunch and you would see every, you know, a couple of times you'd see Paul McCartney, but he'd be walking so quickly, you know, and I always sort of remember reading an interview where he did that because, you know, he knew that if people, you know, did the sort of second sort of look thing, you know, they'd be on him. So, yeah, you would kind of sort of see him around. But, no, that was the first time. And I think I was his favourite for about a year, you know, because I remember, actually, you know, I've still got, and it's a cassette as well. He called in not long after 9/11, and because he was on the tarmac. I mean, I'm sure Mark would know about this, but he was telling us about, you know, being on the tarmac after the planes going into the buildings, and then I also did him for an album, an EPK, and it's just the most surreal experience, which I'm sure you two will get, you know, because every now and then this little voice, it's fucking Paul McCartney. Jesus, you know,
on the outside, you're relaxed. You're sitting there pretending you're having a casual conversation. Inside, jumping up and down inside you is, that's Paul McCartney. Yeah. And you're here. You know what I mean? There's two things. Yeah. Going on in parallel there. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So we were hoping to be able to sell your CD here today,
yes,
Gary. But
yes.
Unfortunately, it's not here. But
no.
Plug away your
Someone's
CD.
Someone's backside will be...
Yes, you can imagine. The wrath of Gary Crowley is something you dread.
So this is a lost 80s CD, isn't
it? Volume 2.
Volume
2. Yeah, the inspiringly titled.
That's how much
and
of the 80s was lost.
Well, I found it. But it's interesting. I think, you know, all of us, you know, we'll always have an affection for the music of our sort of late teens, early 20s. And, you know, I was spoiled. I was given my own radio show when I was, you know, 19 years of age in 1982 to play whatever I wanted to play. And, you know, thankfully, that has been the case the whole way through, and long may it continue. But you know, that part of the 80s, because these two albums do focus on the first half of the 80s. I do think that, you know, a lot of those music makers of that time, you know, there's that wonderful influence of punk, you know, that DIY have a go attitude. But you know, it was still about the song, you know, and I think the influence of, you know, all those great songwriters, artists of the 60s and the 70s permeates, I think, on a lot of those bands, those artists, those songs, because they were either direct influences or they were trying to ape them in some way. So,
So you were at the Wag Club as a DJ for a while and did a lot of suburban DJing as well. And there you were, you know, Wham and Spandau Ballet, Bananarama. Was there any kind of underrated act from the 80s that you thought deserved a little bit more attention and success than they got?
Oh, God, that's a good... I mean... I was a massive Haircut 100 fan. I remember, you know, vividly seeing them for the first time at the Embassy Club in 1981. And again, that was a, you know, 80-81 was a very interesting year, I think, because, you know, it was beginning to change a little bit. It was about the dance floor. And I always remember going to see Haircut at the Embassy Club, and there was, you know, literally a handful of people in there and thinking, wow, it's going somewhere different now. It was about dancing again.
They seem so 80s now, don't they? The mental image of Nick Haywood
songs,
with a kind of
great
pastel,
songs.
Pastel jumper.
Oh, great songs.
Draped over his shoulders. Oh, fantastic songs.
Great songs. I'll say it once more. Great songs. And you know, I always sort of think with Haircut, what the second album might have sounded like, but you know, they unfortunately imploded. But in answer to your question, Mark, around that time we sadly lost Bob Sargent, the producer, this week, who's, you know, produced a couple of my favourite albums, the first Beat album and the first Haircut 100 album, and he also produced another band called Friends Again. Do you remember Friends Again? They were from Glasgow, and yeah, you know, Glasgow in the early 80s was this sort of, you know, hotbed of musical activity, and Bob produced them. They were signed to Mercury Phonogram, and you know, like a lot of those bands in Glasgow at the time, there was a dance influence, but you know, there was a bit of the Byrds and the Velvets going on. There were this real sort of mishmash of influences, and sadly, again, like Haircut, they kind of imploded straight after that first album. Any fans of Friends Again out there? I mean, just, they should have been enormous, you know, Honey at the Core, Sunkissed. You know,
well,
South of Love.
40 years later, here we are talking about.
Well,
them.
If you get 2 minutes in your, you know, maybe this evening, I don't think you'd be disappointed. And just, can I just plug another band who I thought, you know, only made the one album and should have been absolutely enormous? It's one of my favourite albums. A band called Cashier Number 9, who made a great album for Simon Raymond's Bella Union. What was the bloody title of it now? It's gone. But again, if you get 2 minutes, it's, you know, it's just great songs. You know, they're like the sort of bastard sons of the Stone Roses or something.
So these are represented on your new CD?
No, Friends Again were on the first compilation.
All right, okay.
The new one is you know, more of the same, you know, maybe kind of sort of tapping into the sort of soulful, kind of jazzier influence of 83, 84,
right.
You know, Working Week, Style Council,
so that's
Swing
coming
Out
out
Sister.
Soon.
Out next Friday.
Finish with a plug. What a professional. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Crowley.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.